Page 94, the Private Eye Podcast.
Hello and welcome to another episode of Page 94. My name is Andrew Hunter-Murray and this week we have two stories about the fabric of British life today. The first takes us to the northeast, to Teesside, where there have been some extremely interesting goings-on to do with something called a freeport. And if you haven't heard of a freeport, get used to that word, because you're going to be hearing lots more of it over the next half an hour. And after that, we're going to have Tim Minogue, who has been looking in the southeast of the country at some other interesting business decisions that have been made, particularly those going on in the London borough of Croydon, which is now flat broke and very, very keen for a government bailout. Tim will be telling us all about the London borough of Croydon and its absolutely awful finances in a little bit. But first, we go northeast to Teesside. Richard Brooks has been covering the very tangled and murky story of the Teesside Freeport for many months now. He's actually written a special report for Private Eye all about it. And so it's high time that we got him into the studio and asked exactly what is going on there. It's a story that's still being uncovered, but it has absolutely everything in it. It has hundreds of millions of pounds of money sloshing unaccountably around. It has large amounts of scrap metal. It has industrial chemicals. It has the endorsement of the Prime Minister himself. So here is Richard Brooks. I started off by asking him the simple question, what is a freeport? Here's Richard.
Freeport is a special area that has a lot of tax advantages, principally customs duties. The idea is that a freeport area isn't treated as part of the country that it's in for customs purposes. So you move stuff in and out without it being considered as the stuff actually coming into the country.
Right. Just to make sure I'm understanding it properly, let's say you and I establish our own freeport on the coast down in, I don't know, Sussex.
Yeah.
What? What can we do with
Eastbourne.
It?
Eastbourne.
Yeah, Eastbourne. Lovely. The Eastbourne Freeport Association.
Yeah.
What can we do? What can we import? We can import things into the Freeport.
Yeah. The idea is that you import things into the Freeport without any duties being paid.
Great. Okay.
Right. As you would have to if you brought them into the country proper. And then you can do things with them.
Okay. So are we importing raw materials and then processing them?
That's the idea. Raw materials, and then you turn them into something else within the freeport, right, and then you bring them into the country, and they may have a lower level of tariffs because they're a different thing then. They're not the raw materials, they're the finished goods. That's the idea behind it.
And it's to encourage business. That's
the principle.
That right? Yeah.
But the point is, in the age of low tariffs, they're a bit of a waste of time because there aren't those tariffs in the first place. So what they become is an excuse to give other tax benefits to businesses that move into those areas, the idea being that it will boost those areas, which often have been neglected, and promote growth in parts of the country that need it. That's the idea.
Yeah. And so after Brexit, if you no longer have a free trade agreement with the EU, suddenly there's a better case to be made for a free port because there are all these tariffs suddenly, which you might want to avoid.
Well, that would have been the case if we'd had a hard Brexit.
Okay.
When we got the trade agreement, that meant that the tariffs pretty much went away, and for their original purposes, free ports are a complete waste of time, really.
Right. But you're saying that even without the case for them, the government, in particular the current Prime Minister, is very keen.
He's very keen. The reason that I really started looking at them was that whenever Rishi Sunak was asked, what's the benefit of Brexit, he would say, free ports. That was his first answer in every interview.
Right.
And then he'd follow that up by saying, look at what we're doing on Teesside. So, you know, the obvious thing for us to do was to look at what's going on Teesside.
Okay, so now we come to Teesside. For anyone who's not from near Teesside, it's split between Durham and North Yorkshire. And it used to be a huge site on the banks of the River Tees. It specialised in making steel and chemical manufacture, all sorts of things like that.
Yeah.
Now a bit quieter on Teesside.
Yeah, it was home to, we're talking about the south bank of the Tees.
Okay.
And it was home to one of the largest locations of the British steel industry until 2015, when the last company there, Thai company called SSI, upped sticks. And then what was left was a fairly desolate area, like, you know, out of some kind of dystopian film. highly contaminated after, you know, 150, 200 years of industry. Wow. So this is very toxic land, requiring a lot of remediation. But the government decided that it would try to remediate it through a development corporation.
Okay. Next little flag to go up. What's a development corporation?
A development corporation is a publicly owned company, a corporation,
okay,
set up with the intention of promoting development and economic prosperity in a particular area.
Okay.
And this one came along with, and is in fact owned by, the Tees Valley Combined Authority,
right,
which was set up around the same time as part of devolution moves. So it became the first area to have a regional mayor, who was Mr. Ben Houchen.
Okay, who's still the mayor,
who's been still re-elected. The mayor. He was re-elected in 2021 with a thumping majority, largely on the promise of a lot of development on this site. So the development corporation is owned by the combined authority.
Okay, so that's great, publicly owned, and they've got 4,500 acres now of, as you say, really contaminated land. And the plan was to convert it to a kind of green energy beacon.
That's the idea.
That's the current idea still.
The current idea. Green industry will move onto the site.
Right.
There'll be all kinds of waste treatment plants, wind turbine manufacturing factories, and so on. And that it will, as you say, become a bit of a beacon for green industrial development.
Okay. So far, Richard, I'm liking everything I hear.
Yeah.
This sounds great.
Well, just wait.
When's the rug going to be pulled? Because this is so far a rare good news story in the eye.
Well, it's let's get on to what actually happened. That's the point. So after the creation of the development corporation, the combined authority drew up a master plan, as it called it, to redevelop the area.
Okay.
And as we just mentioned, the idea is that a lot of companies would come onto the site. The development corporation would remediate the area with a lot of government money,
right,
hundreds of millions of pounds, and these companies would come on and rent land from the development corporation, which would get income from it, and become sustainable that way, and would have this vibrant setup. What happened in practice was, to achieve this, the South Tees Development Corporation had to acquire the land. Some of the owners of it gave it up or sold it freely. One in particular, this Thai steel company called SSI, or its bankers, wouldn't sell. And the development corporation was forced to compulsorily purchase the land.
Okay.
Now, this is where it got a bit complicated and gave a big opportunity for some local business people. Because while the new mayor, Ben Houchen, was promising to take back what is ours, a bunch of local property developers, or two in particular, spotted an opportunity, and they took an option to lease some land in a particularly important part of the site. They only paid £500,000 for it, but it gave them huge leverage. Now, we're not quite sure exactly how they exercised that leverage, but the upshot was that in return for them giving up that interest, essentially, Ben Houchen gave them 50% control over the whole development. So the
whole 4,500 acre.
Well, it's a bit less than that. That's rough. That's the expanse. But there's bits within it they don't own, but
but
thousands of acres.
50% control?
Yeah, he gave them 50% of a company, a joint venture company called Tees Works Limited.
But they would
own half of it, and the development corporation would own half of it.
This is publicly owned, the development corporation.
The development corporation owned the land, or bought the land through this compulsory purchase.
So is it allowed to just hand over that kind of interest?
Well, this is where the point of this kind of transaction is that it's very controversial. We don't know what the development corporation, in other words, the local and national taxpayer, got in return. And the whole thing was conducted in complete secrecy. There was no mention of this beyond the fact that there would be a joint venture or that there would be business partners. There was no mention of the transaction in any public disclosure. And it's only through lots of freedom of information requests that we found out anything about it.
So, okay, that's kind of extraordinary enough. And I think we say they're led by two guys called Martin Corney and Christopher Musgrave.
That's right, yeah.
So they are now a joint venture with the local authority,
yeah.
Teesworks Limited. There's lots of scrap on the whole site.
Yeah, I mean, scrap doesn't really do it justice. It's extremely valuable.
So what happens next? These guys are in business with the development corporation, so that the plan is still on for the green energy beacon.
I'm starting to get a bit worried about
this green energy beacon, Richard. I don't mind telling you.
Yeah. Well, it's they're charged with running this redevelopment.
Okay.
Right. The development corporation, in other words, the taxpayer, is still paying to remediate the land, and by this time, you know, hundreds of millions have gone in. But this new joint venture, which these business people have half of, they've not only been given their shares in that company, the company has been given options to acquire the land or parcels of the land whenever it wants.
Right.
Okay, so the theory behind this was that the private sector, these business people, would put money in to develop the land because the development corporation is running out of money to do it.
Okay.
They would put more money in. Then when they got an investor, they would buy the land and lease it to the incoming business.
Okay.
Okay. In the event, it seems, they haven't really done that. There's no sign of any money having gone in from the private sector. What there is evidence of is a lot of money going out to these characters.
In what form?
You mentioned the metal, the scrap on the site. There are arrangements under which this joint venture company gets 50% of all that. Okay. And so far we know that more than £70 million has been sold. So that's quite a lot of money.
Yeah, that's good scrap.
The joint venture company, just perhaps we should take it on a step, it is now 90% owned by the business people. Because in 2021, Ben Houch and his board decided to give them a further 40%. So they now 90% own it.
Do we know
so
why?
So almost all the income that goes to that company goes to them.
Right. Do we know why? Do we know why the jump from 50 to 90%?
The official explanation, the explanation that Houchin gave was that, we talked about this area being a free port.
Yeah.
And it's this particular development site is the heart of the Teesside free port. That comes with tax incentives, but some of those are time limited. So Houchin says, well, we've got to get a move on here, otherwise these tax incentives will expire. That means we've got to give these guys an extra incentive, as if they don't have enough. And we'll do that by effectively giving them almost all of this joint venture company.
So, and the joint venture company, it doesn't automatically own the land itself, but it owns a lot of the potential profits to be accrued from this land.
Yeah, because it has options to buy the land. If it doesn't fancy a parcel of land because it's completely toxic and no one's going to go there yet, it doesn't have to have it.
Right.
It can cherry pick, essentially.
Right.
It can take the good bits that businesses are interested in and say, oh, we'll have that. And we'll be the freeholder and we'll lease it to the company coming in.
So can I just check, am I simplifying things when I say that somehow we've ended up with a situation where 90% of the money that can be extracted from the site is going to this private consortium of business people who don't appear, from what you've been able to find, to have put any or much money into the site.
That's right, yeah. And the money comes out, as we mentioned, in the form of scrap, from which they will have earned tens of millions. Right. There's also the rental from that they will own the land that they choose to buy, and they will rent it to whoever, so they'll take that income.
Right.
And also there are sort of side deals that we keep finding. One parcel of land, particularly valuable, is a new quay that is being built on the bank of the Tees. The purpose of this new quay is to bring in and out all the materials to build wind turbines.
Right.
And other green infrastructure. And this has been or is being built with 107 million pounds of money loaned from the UK Infrastructure Bank, which is a public organisation, to the Development Corporation.
Okay.
And so the Development Corporation is keeping the debt. It's essentially paying for this new quay.
Okay.
We know that the business, Tees Works Limited, so in other words, now these business people, have an option to buy the quay, which I understand they have already exercised. We don't know how much for. They will then lease it back to the authority. Right. But there's also a separate agreement that means they will have the right to operate the quay. So they will get income from operating the quay, charging the companies that use this quay. But we also know that they won't, of course, these guys are property developers. They build houses right. and office blocks. Right. They're not really people who operate ports or quays.
Okay.
So what they will do is they will then subcontract it and just take the money.
Right.
So what's happening here is lots of opportunities simply to acquire interests and flip them on and take the money out.
So there is some money that's going into the construction of the quay, as in the Development Corporation is taking on
yeah.
that debt. So that is private money going into it.
No, it's not. It's public money.
Well, it's coming from the loan.
It's a loan from the UK Infrastructure Bank, right. which is a public organisation funded almost entirely by the Treasury. So the public sector is paying for all this stuff.
Yeah.
And to date, all we can see is money being taken out by private interests. We had the land, we have the scrap. I mean, there are other deals that we keep finding. For example, these two business people have sons who are in their 20s. And as chance would have it, set up plant hire companies.
Oh.
Just as their father's got this great deal with the Development Corporation.
That is lucky.
Lo and behold, these start-up companies turn out to be earning huge sums from hiring plant. And you can see the names of their companies emblazoned on the diggers and so on the site.
I'm sure there's a perfectly innocent explanation for all this. So
really?
Have you contacted Mr. Corney, Mr. Musgrave, and just asked them, you know, just to sort of set out what's going on here?
Well, I've asked so many questions of the Development Corporation.
Right.
I just got a very stiff letter from the chief executive, you know, accusing me of being extremely negative.
I'm starting to feel quite gloomy about this green beacon now.
Yeah, it's looking sort of browner,
yeah,
isn't it?
Brownfields. You've been there, haven't you?
I've been a couple of times, yeah. I was given a tour by Mr. Houchin.
Were you?
Yeah.
How was that?
That was interesting. I mean, he was very keen to impress, you know, on me how much was being done. There was some stuff being done.
Yeah.
But, you know, not so keen on answering the hard questions. I went up there to try to examine their records. There's a statutory right to
right.
do that under local government audit legislation. I went up there to exercise that, but was treated to a tour in one of their 4x4s instead.
Oh, well.
So it's a good day out, but it's still proving an uphill battle finding out what's going on with the money.
It sounds like there's lots that is not yet known. I mean, you're saying about the contracts, agreements, payments.
The big questions are things like how much are these private businessmen paying for land that they have the right to acquire,
right?
Versus how much have they put in? It's not looking good on that front, but it's also extremely hard to get the information out.
It sounds like there's more to come.
Yeah, I hope so. It would be much easier for everyone concerned if they just gave the information that we asked for, and then it would be over and done, good or bad, it will be over and done with. But at the moment, it's just kind of dragging on, and we end up with, some of the scandals that appear to be there. We've written recently about the security at the site. Now, Freeports, there aren't many areas where security is more important than Freeports. You know, we talked about broadly what they are, but throughout history, they've been susceptible to financial crime, smuggling, you know, illicit goods, drugs, arms, all sorts going through them. Because they have fewer checks, they're sort of lighter touch, and people really exploit them, criminals exploit them. The security at the Teesside Freeport has been given to a company we've written about that's run by a guy whose son who sort of helped him run this security business until he was done. He spent 11 and a half, well, he got an 11 and a half year sentence for being part of a major drugs gang across the north of England, and convictions for violence and all that kind of thing. They're the security company.
Oh, dear.
You know, they came in when one of these developers, Chris Musgrave, came in, and they go back with him a long way. They have a long business relationship. So there are elements here that are beginning to look a little bit unsavoury.
Yeah. Well, I think we'll be hearing more about this probably over the next however many years it takes for you to unravel it all, Richard.
Yeah, yeah. But if they are listening, it's maybe just time to just open up and let's get it over and done with. That's what I'd say.
Richard Brooks there, and if you are involved in any way in the Teesside Freeport and you'd like to give a full and frank account of what exactly is going on there, all you have to do is email strobes@private-i.co.uk and he'll be in touch. Now we come south to the London borough of Croydon, which is huge, very highly populated and in desperate financial straits. The borough is in deep, deep debts, and at the time of recording, there is no clear sign as to how it's going to get itself out of the perilous financial hole it's managed to get itself into. One of the journalists who knows more about this than anyone else is Tim Minogue, who writes the Eye's Rotten Boroughs column all about mismanagement in local government. Tim came on the podcast to discuss exactly how Croydon got into this situation, and it's a story that is not unique to Croydon either, because all over the country, councils have been resorting to speculative and unusual business practices in an attempt to keep themselves afloat. The reason for that is that since 2010 and since the financial crisis, there has been a drastic cut in the amount of money provided to local councils from central government. Here's Tim.
Some have dabbled in the property market, buying shopping centres, just as shopping centres were going out of favour with the online shopping boom. Some have got involved in energy companies, not terribly successful. Now, quite a lot of councils have set up their own housing building companies. And this is partly to try and do something about the housing crisis. And it's partly in response to the fact that in recent decades, it's been very difficult for the old model of council house building to take place because central government won't provide the funds. It made borrowing more difficult to do that. So councils have come up with this idea of setting up their own housing companies. And this seems like a good idea on paper.
Yeah.
And quite a few councils who haven't hit the headlines, it has proved practicable. And the amount of social housing provided by councils has been creeping up. But it seems like a good idea because what a lot of councils have done in the past is they've made some money in one-off sales. You know, say they've got a patch of land that they don't need anymore, an old school or something, they will sell it off to a developer, take the money, and then the developer builds lots of houses and flats and makes a fortune. And councils have seen developers doing that and thought, why don't we cut out the middleman? So what Croydon Council did in 2016 was they set up their own housing company called Brick by Brick. The name is taken from something that Herbert Morrison said in the 1940s, I think, that the Labour were going to build the Tories out of London brick by brick. Anyway, they borrowed hundreds of millions of pounds from Croydon Council, and the business model was that they would build up to 500 houses a year, half of them at affordable prices and social housing, and half of them for profit. And the idea was that the private houses, which were sold for profit, would then subsidise the more affordable stuff and help solve the housing crisis. But that was predicated on the fact that if you hit those targets, you would make a certain amount of profit and you would be able to service your debt from the council. But unfortunately, they didn't come anywhere near hitting those targets. And in the 5 years of Brick by Brick's existence, they built fewer than 500 houses altogether.
The figures are astronomical, and the figures are not ones that I associate with I suppose, council spending. So you mentioned, you know, the amount put into Brick by Brick, or rather loaned to Brick by Brick, which is also, you know, a spin-off and basically council-owned. They got £200 million in loans from the council, but the total losses, as you've written, in Rotten Boroughs, have been estimated at somewhere like £100 million. I know Croydon's a big council with a lot of people living in it, but that's an astronomical amount of money not to have any more to spend on services.
This all happened under a Labour regime, and the Tories understandably have used the failure of Brick by Brick as a stick with which to beat Labour. But something that isn't often mentioned is that when Labour took over from the previous Tory regime in 2014, they inherited debts of £720 million. Right. And their total debt now stands at £1.3 billion. So they haven't quite doubled the amount of debt. You can't put it all down to the Brick by Brick debacle, but the Brick by Brick debacle was what tipped them over the edge. Yeah.
So you've mentioned there's an enormous amount of debt now. And what did Croydon do in this situation?
Well, the control of the council passed in May last year from Labour to the Tories. They now have an elected mayor, Mr. Jason Perry, and he's been told by Michael Gove, he's been given permission, as it were, to raise council tax by 15%, which obviously is way beyond the previous limit. Interestingly, when this was announced, something like 25 or 30,000 residents of Croydon signed a petition saying, you know, please don't do this to us. I think it would have been well over £200 extra a year each. And it was seen by the residents as they were getting punishment for the failures of the previous council. A couple of weeks ago, there was a vote on it, and all the Tories, I think that was about 34 councillors, voted for it. But the Labour and the other opposition councillors all voted against it. So the thing was voted down. And Labour were very robust in saying this mustn't happen. And then last week, that would be Thursday the 9th of March, there was another vote in the council, and the Labour Party, to the shock and dismay of many of their supporters, and indeed I think many of the Labour councillors, they abstained. So it was passed, and the 15% will go ahead. One is slightly at a loss to explain this change of track. One can only think that perhaps the Labour leadership at a national level told them to do this.
So raising council tax by 15%, it feels like won't
touch it.
£1.3 billion of debt. What else could they do? Are there bailouts available?
This is the question. As we speak today, Michael Gove is considering a request from Mayor Perry to write off £540 million worth of that stonking debt, which is more than a third of it. Now, that would put the council on, not on a sound financial footing, but it wouldn't be particularly more in debt than any other councils.
Okay.
But the interesting thing about that is this is completely unprecedented. No government has ever let a council off so much money before.
Right.
And if they can do it for Croydon, council leaders up and down the land are saying, oi, you know, you have to do it for us as well.
Okay, well, that kind of, so that's the current state of play, and you know, more on this as we have it, and I'm sure we'll read more about it in the Rotten Boroughs column in the next few weeks. My other question really is about accountability for all this. These are such large sums of money being invested, spent, lost. What happens in terms of the paper trail of responsibility and accountability once this is over?
After the council announced its bankruptcy in November 2020, a very experienced expert from the local government association, a man called Richard Penn, was sent in. He interviewed something like 64, 65 members of staff and councillors there. And he pretty much put his finger on what was to blame. There were a number of top officials were named, particularly the former leader of the council, who's a man called Tony Newman. I mean, he's laying it at the door of him and of the former chief executive, Joe Negrini. Ms. Negrini, who now works for the building company Arup, she got a payoff of $440,000. So that hasn't really impressed the the voters there. Now, the thing about this report, was ready 2 years ago, and the current chief executive of the council, a woman called Catherine Kurzweil, has managed not to release it for 2 years. That has allowed people who were at a senior level in the council to move on, to go elsewhere. Ms. Negrini has invested her $440,000, and the Mr. Newman, the former leader, he stood down a long time ago. So the opportunity to sanction any of these people seems to be getting more and more remote, wouldn't you? Wouldn't you know? What a surprise. For instance, one of the things that Penn says in his report is that the council should look at ways of getting some of this money back from Negrini, because, you know, she, if you look at the, you know, why be rewarded with nearly £500,000 for bankrupting a council? But the council's lawyers had looked at the prospect of this, and they concluded, well, half of this payoff was an enhancement of her pension, which, however extreme you might think that to be, that's untouchable. They can't get their hands on any of that. And then whenever lawyers are involved, large sums of money start to disappear. So it was concluded that it probably wouldn't be worth their while trying to get any of this money back. But Mr. Penn says that the former leader of the council and the former cabinet member for finances, they could be looked at as to whether they'd breached the councillor's code of conduct.
Oh.
Okay, so should they ever have such a hearing and they find that, well, these people aren't councillors anymore anyway, so what are you going to do about it? And then the very last paragraph in his report, he says, members are also requested to consider referring the initial report to the Metropolitan Police for assessment of any further action being warranted in regard to the handling of public money and conduct in public office. Now, I think the residents of Croydon would like to see that, but certainly to this date, Ms. Kurzweil hasn't endorsed that or said that referral to Inspector Nacker will happen. But, you know, she could. I wouldn't put money on it.
Tim Minogue there. And in the couple of days since we recorded that interview, there has as yet been no announcement about whether Croydon is actually going to get this bailout. Watch this space, specifically the page of Private Eye marked Rotten Boroughs, for more as it happens. That's it for this episode of Page 94. We hope you've enjoyed it. We are going to be back again soon with another one. It was produced, as ever, by Matt Hill of Rethink Audio. And if you would like to get hold of 40 solid pages of finely typed, well-written, groundbreaking stories, you can do so either by going to a newsstand, that's great, but even better, by going to private-i.co.uk and clicking the big button marked subscribe. We recommend it, you won't regret it. Thanks again, and we'll see you next time. Goodbye.